So in the last one of these talks, I made a lot of claims, and one claim in particular that I made was that if we consider a particular theory that I called type 2 string theory on a space-time, so in general, the space-time in type 2 string theory is a 10-manifold, and I said that if we take that 10-manifold to be of this particular shape, to be a product, R31 cross Z, Riemannian product, where Z is compact, and in fact, Ricci flat Kähler, in other words, compact Calabi-Yau threefold. So that's a complex threefold, so real dimension 6. Think of this Z as being a kind of internal space. Think of it as being extremely, extremely small. So if we're observers walking around in this R3, 1, there's this Z which is incredibly small and which somehow isn't visible to us directly. Nevertheless, what I said last time was that we'll detect some properties of Z indirectly. And in particular, to observers who live in R3, 1, or observers living in R3, 1, will see they'll go to their particle accelerators or to their physicists, and they'll do experiments. And one of the experiments that they'll do, one of the first things that they'll measure, is what are all the possible massless particles in their universe. So in our universe, as far as we know, the answer is there's one massless particle, the photon. These people will measure something. They'll measure the spectrum of massless particles.
Just to ask a theoretical question.
Yeah.
Is there some feeling that there is a mechanism that requires there only to be one massless particle?
Oh, the question is...
Because, decades ago, there was an expectation that there was more than one.
Because, for example, the neutrino was supposed to be massless. No. So the question is there some general mechanism that would say that there should be only one? No, indeed not. So in our particular universe, at the moment, it seems that we know about one. For example, people in this universe, what they're going to see is potentially a bunch of massless particles. They're going to see massless particles corresponding to cohomology classes on X. To be exact, it was H11 and H21 that appeared in the discussion last time. And then the statement was, moreover, that if the observers in this universe do some experiments where they take these particles and shoot them at each other, then they'll detect finer things such as the Gromov-Witten invariance of X. But the first thing is just to look at the spectrum of particles. Just ask what massless particles are there, and that's supposed to be detected by the cohomology of X.
What do you mean if there's only one? Is it rigid then? That's the second thing.
What does H11 of X
even mean? Oh, he means
Z. Z. Corresponding cohomology classes on Z. So it's not believed that our universe is described by type 2 string theory on a compact Calabi-Yau threefold. So this is something about sort of hypothetical universe. I just want to say that the statement is about as concrete as the statement in our universe that there's exactly one. It's something you literally just physically measure. So the question arose, why is this true? So I want to give you some indication of what's the general mechanism that makes this kind of thing happen. Now, this is a statement about... this is, in principle, a statement about string theory, which is a complicated quantum theory, but you can understand the basic mechanism just purely in terms of classical field theory. So I'm going to tell you the story in classical field theory. And in classical field theory, actually, the mathematical content, as you'll see, is something really very simple. So let me talk a little bit about classical field theory. Now let's just let X be any space-time. In other words, I'll take space-time to just be a smooth manifold. And we're going to study classical field theory on X. So the first thing that you need in classical field theory is notion of what's a field. So corresponding to any smooth manifold, there's going to be a space of fields, the field space. So the simplest thing you could imagine would be to have something like just functions on X, the space of all functions on X. Let's take complex valued functions. So,
for those of us who are just out in left field, did we somehow lose the fact that X has a compact component?
We're going to come back to that later. So that's going to, for now, I'm starting out pretty generally. X is just anything, and then we'll specialize to a product in a little bit. So classical field theory is concerned with, you have some space of fields, so maybe it's functions, maybe it's more complicated things like bundles, sections of bundles, even higher kind of things. But let's start out just thinking of functions. And then in classical field theory, you're supposed to have an action functional, which is just a map from the field space to R. And as far as classical physics goes, what you're mostly interested in is actually the critical locus of this functional. So there's the principle of least action, which says that the equations of motion, you know, Newton's laws, if you like, in this classical field theory, will be given by extremizing this action. So in other words, we're interested in fields for which are critical points of this action functional phi. So what's the basic example? The basic example is complex scalar. Well, a basic example is the complex scalar. I'll say the massive complex scalar for a reason that'll appear in a minute. So let's literally take f of x to be just the complex valued functions on x. And let's suppose that x isn't just a manifold, but it comes with a metric. Which might be Riemannian or Lorentzian. For people who are interested in even keeping track of the signs, I'm going to be in the convention that quantum field theorists often use, where for the Riemannian metric, I'll actually make it be negative definite, and for a Lorentzian metric, it'll be 1 plus for the time direction and the rest all minus. So we have some metric. And let's fix also let's fix a number, positive or zero. So then we can define an action. So the action is supposed to be a real valued function on the field space. And what will the function be? It'll be, so given phi, which is a map from x to c, we consider this. We consider the integral over x of d phi squared minus m squared norm of phi squared, integrated against the volume measure of x. Okay, so that's a good action. So if I give you a function on x, you can compute this number. And now, just to be sure, so by d phi squared here, what I mean is d phi dot d phi bar, if you wanted to write it out in coordinates, so if call this metric g, if you wanted to write it out in coordinates, you would use the inverse metric, derivative of phi, derivative of phi bar. So that's what I mean concretely. This is a kind of, if you like, kinetic energy that tells you how much the field varies, and this is a kind of potential energy which tells you how big the field is. So then, what are the equations of motion in this classical field theory? So the equations of motion are the equations that say that phi is a critical point of this action. So what do you have to do? You have to consider a small deformation of this and ask that the variation of s under that deformation is zero. So that's a sort of standard exercise in calculus of variations, and what you get the classical solutions, or in other words, the extrema of s, are the fields obeying this equation. Laplacian of phi equals minus m squared phi. So if this parameter m was just zero, then this is just the equation that gives you harmonic functions. And if m is not zero, then this is some deformation of the harmonic function equation. So let me think about this. Let's think about this really concretely. Let's think about the case where x, in fact, is just a Lorentzian vector space. So for example, say x is R, then 1 comma n. So then the Laplace operator is the Laplace operator with respect to this Lorentzian metric. So it's, I'll use 0 for the plus direction and 1 up to n for the minus directions. So in other words, this is the time direction and these are the space directions. So what is the equation concretely? Well, so in this case, okay, so now the equation becomes something completely concrete in terms of the second derivatives of phi, and we can write down a sort of basis of solutions of this equation just in terms of, they're just the Fourier modes. So we can write down a basis of solutions. Of this equation star, they're just of the form phi of x is e to the I k dot x, where so x is in R1 comma 9, k is the so this is a free parameter labeling the solution. So I might have written the solution as phi k of x. And so this k lives also in R1 comma n. I'm using the dot product here. We could have said, if we didn't want to use the dot product, we could say it lives in the dual. Anyway, so we have a whole family of solutions labeled by these vectors k. But they're not all solutions. So if I just choose an arbitrary k, I won't get a solution here. So if I take this and I plug it into that equation, what I'll find is that this is a solution if this vector k obeys the norm of k squared equals m squared. So norm of k squared, longhand, what I mean is literally k0 squared minus k1 squared minus dot, 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 up to minus kn squared. Okay, so here we're studying a classical field theory, and we found that in this classical field theory, there are very simple solutions which correspond to kind of propagating waves in space. And those waves, they propagate with some sort of characteristic momentum, this k. And k is not arbitrary, but it's constrained to obey this equation. Now, how should we think about this? So I want to identify this m as the mass of some kind of, well, it's the mass of the field, but I want to identify it with the usual notion of the mass of a particle. So for that, let me take a little detour and remind you of a little bit about special relativity. So special relativity concerns itself with dynamics that occur exactly in this space in R1 comma n. So we take space-time as R1 comma n. And particle trajectories, so free particle trajectories, in space-time are labeled exactly by vectors k in R to the 1 comma n. Which you think of, if you want to relate this to the usual kind of Galilean physics, the way you would think of it is that the first component, the time component, is the energy of the particle, and the other components, I'll write them P1 up to Pn. So this is the energy, and this is the momentum. The energy momentum of the particle are constrained to obey this relativistic energy momentum relation. Well, the relation, so E squared minus the norm of this vector P, E squared minus P squared equals M squared. Or in other words, the norm squared of this momentum vector is M squared. So if you have encountered this before, if you've studied special relativity before, the point of this is to show you that the relation that we encounter here, where this M is called the mass, is exactly the relation that we're encountering here in this classical field theory. So now here I'm talking about classical fields. Here I'm talking about particles. But indeed, in the quantization of this classical field theory, these waves, the wave which I wrote here, phi of x equals e to the ikx, will get quantized exactly into a particle with momentum k. So that we have to just take on faith for a minute. But supposing that we accept that, then the m which appeared here really has the interpretation of the mass of a particle. So the upshot of that, the upshot of all that is, if I go back to this action that I wrote here, whenever I see a field that has an action like this, so for a scalar, literally an action that's represented exactly like this, I'm going to interpret this M as being the mass of the particle. So with that said, now we're going to go on and do some manipulations just in classical field theory.
In this quantization thing,
yeah.
you have some basis, and the basis lifts. You know, if you just have an algebra and you have the central fiber, there's no way of lifting functions from that. You know, when you have a deformation, you can't sort of lift things from the central unless there's some kind of basis.
Yeah, this problem is particularly simple because everything's completely free. So a lot of things happen here that don't happen in a sort of more general situation. So let me for a moment avoid... so we're going to interpret M to be the mass. And with that in mind, okay, now let me go into this Kaluza-Klein mechanism. So now, suppose we study classical field theory in a space-time X, which, so before I took it to be Rn comma 1. Now let's take it to be the product of something, some y, and I don't even care what y is, cross a circle. A circle of radius r. So what do I mean by that? So y is going to be Riemannian or Lorentzian like before. And the circle is carrying the Riemannian metric with length literally 2 pi times r. And I'll coordinatize it by... alpha, which runs from 0 to 2 pi r. And just as before, we'll write the action. We'll study a single scalar field propagating in this space X. So it's a... Yeah, no, I just mean, think of this circle as being coordinatized by a coordinate alpha.
Yes,
Which goes from 0 to 2 pi r. If you like, think of it as the quotient of r by z, where z acts by shifts by 2 pi r. Okay. And alpha is the coordinate along r.
Different notation.
Okay. So we're going to study this classical field theory again, but now the classical field theory is going to be on this x. So I'm rewriting again the action, just the same as before. But now, let me think of it in the following way. So since x is of this special shape, we could consider Fourier expanding this field phi. So let's write phi of y and alpha. So y is a coordinate here. Alpha is a coordinate here. And let's just expand it with some normalization. expanded in Fourier modes over the circle. So phi n of y, e to the I n alpha over r. So we have this infinite tower of Fourier modes. Each of them has arbitrary dependence on the coordinates here, and you know it's some Fourier mode along the circle. So suppose we do that, and now let's look again at the action. So let me just substitute this Fourier expansion into the action. So now, I guess I normalized it with a half. So we have a half the integral over, integral over x, which was y cross the circle. And so now, if I substitute in this form for phi, what will I get? So I get this, everything's quadratic in phi, so I get 2 pi r coming out in the front. Then I have, again, the integral over y across the circle. Now I have a sum over n and n prime, because phi appears twice, and I'm going to expand both of them. And now I have d phi n dot d phi bar n prime. That's the term that which comes from the derivatives in the y directions. Then I have, in addition to that, the derivatives in the circle direction. And those pick up a factor of n over r for differentiation in the alpha direction, times phi n phi bar n prime. And then I have the mass term, which goes along just like before, minus m squared phi n bar prime. And all of this is multiplied by I n minus n prime alpha over r. So all I did is I just took my fields and Fourier expanded everything, and now I got this. Now if I do the integral over the circle, now I can just explicitly, so this is times d volume of y, d alpha. And now I can just do the integral over alpha. All the alpha dependence is explicitly right here. So let's just do that integral. Then what will we get? Well, because of the orthogonality of the Fourier modes, the only contribution will come from n equals to n prime. And from that term, we'll just get integral. So now we've got integral over y with infinitely many pieces. Which looks like this, d volume of y. So now we started out with a field theory in sort of one higher dimension. We started out with a field theory in y cross a circle of a single field. And now we've kind of reinterpreted that field theory as a field theory in y, just in y. But now instead of one field, we have infinitely many fields. Well, they were just the Fourier modes that we had before. It's not a big deal. So we have infinitely many fields, phi n. Each one of them is a complex valued function on y. So this is a classical field theory of infinitely many fields, phi n, on y. But each one has a mass. So what is the mass? The mass is just the coefficient of the quadratic term in front of this thing. So now, before we had this m squared, now we have that plus this contribution that came from the derivatives in the circle direction. So the mass is now the mass that the higher dimensional thing had plus this additional contribution, n squared over r squared. So in particular, an interesting special case is the case where the field originally had no mass at all, where the field in the higher dimensional theory had no mass at all. In that case, we get something particularly nice. Well, particularly simple anyway. So then we get...
But these guys, they sort of don't interact at all.
Well, that's right. So this particular theory I chose to be very simple. Everything is quadratic. There were no kind of higher order terms. Now, had there been higher order terms, there would have been interactions between these things. But nevertheless, all the questions about the mass are determined by the quadratic part. So what I'm saying about the quadratic part is still relevant even in an interacting theory. So what we've got now is a whole pile of fields with these masses, and in particular, there's one field which is actually massless, namely the one that corresponded to the constant Fourier mode. You might call it the zero mode. So the constant mode gives rise to a massless field in the lower dimensional theory. All the other modes give rise to massive fields, and they're more and more massive according to how fast they're fluctuating. So,
it's not massless, it has mass m squared.
Well, yeah, I said m is zero. So if m is... Right, so...
Oh, sorry.
So if I happen to set m is zero, then so the sort of constant Fourier mode is massless, and then as you go to the higher Fourier modes, you get things which are more and more massive. Okay. And in particular, okay, so the constant mode gives you something massless, and as r goes to zero, all of the modes except for the massless one, all of the massive ones are becoming more and more massive. So in the limit where I take this circle to be extremely small, if I measure the spectrum of particles that I can measure, what I'll see is that as r gets smaller, the particles are getting all but the zero mode are getting more and more massive. And so in a sense, they're harder and harder to measure. So if imagine that I've only got a finite amount of energy in my accelerator. As this thing gets more and more massive, eventually there will come a point where I can't put any energy into that mode, because I can only put it in sort of quantized units. If I can't create even a single particle of this kind of massive excitation, then to me it's almost as if that thing doesn't exist at all. So it's in that sense that if that circle is very small, I can't really see it. I have no way of exciting the modes of these higher things. So all that is to say that in some approximation, in the limit where this r becomes very small, I really only see the massless stuff. Okay, which in this case meant I just see the constant mode. The non-zero mn go to infinity. Okay. Well, I said all that for this very special case of a product with a circle. But now, similarly, we could consider a product X is Y cross Z for Z compact, and do a similar thing. So again, I'll take my fields on X, and I'll expand them in modes in now eigenmodes of the Laplace operator. So now it's not Fourier modes, but it's eigenmodes of the Laplace operator on Z. And I'll get whatever I get. So, so suppose we study again a single scalar field phi on X of mass, say, M. We can do just the same thing as we did before. We can expand it as, so I'll write phi of Y and Z. I'll expand it into sum of modes, phi n of y, e n of z, where e n, before they were the Fourier modes around the circle, now they're the eigenmodes of the Laplacian. So the Laplace operator in the z direction, e n of z, I'll just write e n. So we might diagonalize the Laplacian, so it has the constant mode lambda 0, lambda 1, lambda 2, dot, dot, dot. Okay, so if we do that, and again we do this game now of writing the action originally on X, and then expanding in this way, and integrating now over the Z directions. So integrating over Z. What are we going to get? Well, now we'll get an action again. An action functional, which is now in terms of this infinite collection of fields. An action in terms of this infinite tower of fields on Y. They're all decoupled, and each one separately looks like one of these massive scalar fields with the masses of these various particles are going to be mn, well, mn squared is m squared, whatever the bare mass was in the higher dimensional thing, plus lambda n, the eigenvalues of the Laplacian. So in this case, you know, if you're able to measure the spectrum of all the particles and all of their masses, then what you're detecting is just the spectrum of the Laplace operator on the internal manifold. And once again, there's exactly one massless field, phi zero, corresponding to the constant mode on this internal space Y. So this one has, well, again, if we take the field to be massless in the higher dimensional theory, then we'll get exactly one massless thing in the lower dimensional theory, corresponding to the zero mode of the Laplacian. Okay. So now, finally, I can explain.
What happened to your R goes to zero business?
Oh yeah. Okay. Great. So at finite value of R, for any fixed choice of the Riemannian metric on the internal space, I get this spectrum. And now, just like before, I could imagine taking the metric on the internal space to be smaller and smaller. So here, yeah, indeed. So if we rescale. The metric on Z. So we had this internal space Z, which had some metric, and if we rescale it by a factor, let's just uniformly rescale it. So then the spectrum of the Laplacian just gets multiplied. So each lambda n just gets multiplied by, or divided by beta squared. So just as before, so in the limit where beta goes to zero, as beta goes to zero, all of these masses, well, they're proportional to 1 over beta, and so in particular they go to infinity. So it's just like before. You know, you have this internal space, and in the limit where that internal space becomes extremely small, all the particles that correspond to the sort of non-zero modes of the Laplacian become extremely massive. And so in some sense, they're less and less relevant to the physics that you can directly measure. Okay, so now I'm in a position to motivate this thing that I said last time about the cohomology of Calabi-Yau. So now let me come to string theory. Okay, well, now string theory is certainly not a classical field theory. I mean, I've just been talking about classical field theory. So it's not a classical field theory, but what is true is that string theory is supposed to describe some 10-dimensional universe, and the observers in that 10-dimensional universe, what they're supposed to see, if they look at low enough energies, what they're supposed to see is given by the quantization of a classical field theory. So it's approximately described. Low energies, described by a quantum field theory, which you think of as the quantization of a classical field theory. And so for determining what's going to be the spectrum of particles that observer is going to see, looking at the classical field theory underlying this quantum field theory, so it's even more than a quantum field theory. It's a quantum field theory which really comes by quantization of a classical field theory. So looking at the mass terms in that classical field theory is a good sort of first approximation to what you'll get. So let's just do that.
what I was asking before. So for each one of these sort of eigenspaces that you have, which you're calling particles,
yeah,
they're supposed to have some kind of canonical lift to the quantization.
That's right. So, yeah, that's right. That's right. So the coefficient, if you like, so I had some Fourier modes of the field, and the coefficients of those Fourier modes are supposed to get promoted to operators.
Right.
Those operators have the interpretation as the operator which creates that particle. So yeah. So the quantum field theory that you get in string theory is not exactly like this this massive scalar field theory that I've been describing up till now. But if you only look at the quadratic part of it, it's actually not so far off. So so we're interested in the question, what are going to be the massless particles? So we know from this Kaluza-Klein mechanism that I showed you, the only time you get massless particles is if you start with a massless particle in the higher dimensional theory. There was the contribution m squared to the lower dimensional mass. So let's look at what are the massless particles in the in this 10-dimensional.
And you can just, if you don't mind, but also you can just tell me each other.
Yeah.
I forget from your class. What's the big difference when you have this? In the string theory, is it these non-commuting variables, or?
Why is string theory different from quantum field theory?
Yeah, I mean, why don't you just have some fields and action and?
No, so the thing is that it's not. People have tried to describe string theory in that kind of way, in terms of fields propagating in 10-dimensional space. There's a thing which is called string field theory. So, the first difficulty is that it always involves. It always involves infinitely many fields. Now, that shouldn't be surprising. I showed you already some examples of things with infinitely many fields. And indeed, these infinitely many fields have sort of higher and higher masses. But the interactions between these infinitely many fields are very intricate. And people haven't really succeeded in making... People have made some calculations, but to answer sort of simple questions like, what's the scattering amplitude for two particles going into two other particles, people haven't been very successful in using this... this formalism, this sort of totally field-theoretic formalism. Instead, people have had more luck using this other formalism, which I described to you a little bit, involving integration over moduli of Riemann surfaces. So it's believed that what that gives you is equivalent to what the string field theory would give you, but people don't really know how to get it that way.
Okay. The string field theory itself has infinitely many fields?
Yeah.
Can you expand the string field out in terms of...
No, I mean, the usual way of thinking of the string field is... Yeah, if you think of it in terms of conventional fields on space-time, there's infinitely many of those fields.
Right, but you can write down some operator which...
Let me not get into it. If you think of it as a conventional field theory, that conventional field theory has infinitely many fields.
Okay.
So I told you that string theory is described by, in some approximation, the quantization of a classical field theory. And let me tell you, what are the fields in that classical field theory? Well, there's infinitely many of them. Let me tell you just about the massless ones. I mean, in fact, this is kind of the string field theory, but I'm just truncating it to tell you only the massless part. So as it turns out, so in the string theory that I told you, the type 2A string... the fields are, so there is a scalar, there is a scalar field, but there's also a one-form, call it C1, a three-form, C3, a two-form, a symmetric two-tensor, and then in addition to all of this, there are the fermionic fields, the sort of odd fields, which I don't want to talk much about here. The statement is that the field space is actually a supermanifold. So let me just look at the sort of even part of that supermanifold. That's these fields here. So this answer comes from studying the quantization of the string, much in the way that I told you last time, if you do it in the supersymmetric theory instead of the ordinary one. Anyway, however you get it, this is the spectrum. And now let's see just how that leads to... how that leads to this business about cohomology. So the action... So let me just write the action for the forms. The action for the forms looks not so different from what I've written before. So you have a 10-dimensional manifold. So X is now some 10-manifold. And to quadratic order, what you write is just... So before I wrote d phi squared, now I'll write dc squared. Now this is the exterior derivative, so you feel like it's the curvature of that one form. And we'll write a similar thing for the 3 form, and a similar thing for the 2 form, in fact. So this is plus various complicated sort of interaction terms. So not quadratic. But as far as the quadratic stuff goes, which is the leading thing in the approximation where the fields are very small, if you like. As far as the quadratic stuff goes, this is what it looks like. And so now, suppose that we do the same thing that I did for the scalar field theory. Suppose I take my space-time to be a product. So I take my 10-manifold to be factorized like this. And again, I'll take Z to be compact. So then, once again, each one of these fields is going to now decompose into some infinite tower of fields thought of as functions on Y, just expanding in modes on Z. Well, the mode expansion is a little bit more complicated now because the thing is not just a scalar. The mode expansion of the thing is a little more complicated because it's not just a scalar. So what it looks like is, let's just pick one of the fields. Let's look at the field, say, C3, the 3 form. So I have this 3 form, and I want to expand it now in things on Y and things on Z. So we have 3 form on X, space of 3 forms on X. What is it? Well, you know, of course, that it just splits up into I forms on Y and 3 minus I forms on Z. I guess I should write direct sum. So in particular, then, so I have this field C3 of Y and Z. So I can break it up first into 4 pieces, according to the grading here. And then each of those pieces I can Fourier expand. So for example, we'll take the part here. So here, phi n of y, I'm taking to be just a function on y. And here's a 3 form on z. And then there'll be similar terms with a 1 form and a 2 form and so on. Suppose I'm interested only in the things which will give me scalars on y. Then I'm only looking at this part. Where the ens, so now, what are these en of z's? So they're 3 forms. And once again, I can take them to be eigenmodes of the Laplacian. Now it's the 3-form Laplacian. Nabla z, the 3-form Laplacian. Delta z is the Laplace operator acting on 3 forms. And so now, what will we get? So it's completely parallel to the story that we had before. So we've expanded this thing. We've expanded our one field C3 in terms of an infinite pile of fields phi n of y. You do the integral over z. You're left with an action just for these fields. And the action just for those fields up to quadratic order. So now we just get a scalar field theory. For the phi n of y, whose masses now are given by the eigenvalues. So it's again controlled by the eigenvalues of the Laplacian, but now it's the Laplacian for 3 forms. So in particular, if I make just as before, if I make this z very small, all the masses that are non-zero will be going off to infinity. So I'll be particularly interested in the zero modes, the massless things. And so what are the massless things? Well, the massless things will come from the kernel of the Laplace operator, right? The zero modes. But what is that? So that has this kind of topological significance, right? The kernel of the Laplace operator, acting on three forms, is nothing but the third cohomology. So that says that if I want to determine the number of massless particles that are going to appear in this expansion, the number of massless fields that I'll get, that number is just the third Betti number of the space. So that's the reason, that's the reason why the cohomology of the internal space has something to do with the spectrum of massless particles. It ultimately just comes down to this. So mathematically, well, okay, I said it would be trivial. I mean, this is quite a deep thing. But modulo that thing, which I suppose you already know, the mathematics here isn't something really new. But of course, the fact that the massless particles correspond to cohomology is sort of the beginning of this richer story that I said a little bit about last time. Oh yeah, great. So of course, that's right. So you get scalars. So from the three form you get scalars. But of so here I just took this part of the expansion. But you ask, what about the other parts, right? So indeed, there's also I need a different notation for them. So I'll call them phi 1 n of y. Exactly. So
like an observer on Y is unaware of this small z, would sense massless scalar fields that come from.
Right. So even though this observer can't detect z directly, they can nevertheless detect the third Betti number of z by measuring how many massless particles they find. Well, okay. Strictly speaking, that would be true if the theory had only this C3. Of course, it doesn't only have C3. It has other massless fields also. And so you somehow have to be able to disentangle which ones are coming from which part of the cohomology.
But I guess the point is that we get the fees are in omega 0 of y. That's why I said scalar.
Well, you're right as far as this field C3 goes. But in the actual string theory, there are more fields than just C3. So as far as the expansion of this C3 goes, you're completely right that the scalar things that are scalar on Y will come only from things that are three forms on Z. But the full string theory has more than just C3. It has this whole zoo of other particles.
So there may be some other non-scalar particles with zero mass.
Well, C3 already would give you non-scalar particles of zero mass. So, okay, let's talk about those two things in turn. So indeed, as you said...
I see.
Right. So
C1 would have a similar term with the omega 0 and an omega 1.
Exactly. Exactly. So there is a little... Of course, there's more structure than what I'm telling you here. So you get various different kinds of massless particle, and by slightly more refined measurements, you can detect which ones came from which part of the cohomology. So what I've explained here is just the very rough statement that cohomology has... I'm trying to roughly motivate why cohomology has to do with massless particles. But indeed, it's true. Maybe I should finish since you brought it up. In fact, this is one way of detecting which is which. So as you said, when we look at this C3 here, it produces scalar particles corresponding to classes in H3. It also produces massless one-forms corresponding to classes in H2. And so if you see a massless one-form, let's see. The massless one-forms, I think, come only from H2, right? Yeah, I think that's right. So if you see a massless one-form, then you can confidently say where it came from. So you know, by looking at the whole spectrum, not just the scalars but also the higher fields, you can detect a little more about this internal space. And then by looking at the interactions in the supersymmetry, you can detect much more. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say. So thanks, I'm done.
So I was sort of disappointed when you said that our universe is not supposed to come in this way.
Well, okay, so
is there some manifold that experiments in our world are talking about?
Okay, so people certainly have tried to get our universe in string theory. But no one thinks that our universe comes from this particular string theory, this type 2 string theory, just on a Calabi-Yau threefold. There are people who have tried using it. Roughly speaking, this universe has too much supersymmetry. It can't possibly be our universe. And one way of seeing that is indeed that this universe tends to have too many massless particles. It's hard to get rid of the... So what I told you here is some approximation to the real story, but even in the exact story, it seems that that in type 2 theory you get too many massless particles. So people try various ways of messing the story up to somehow get rid of some of the massless particles so that it could be our universe. And so you can try to do that, but the thing that I said here is not sufficient. Certainly, there's a whole industry of so-called string phenomenology where people try to do fancier things than what I've done here to really get exactly our universe within string theory. Right now, there isn't a very convincing story. You know, I think back in 1985, people thought, you know, as far as anyone knew, there were 6 Calabi-Yaus, and one of them was probably going to be the right one, and so you just had to, it was only a matter of months before everything was understood. But you know, the reality has turned out to be more difficult.
H11 and H02 or something?
Yes. So, right. So you're right. So here I just wrote H3. So actually, if you look at the... if you look at the Hodge diamond of a Calabi-Yau threefold, what do you have, right? So you have something like this. H11... H12, H21. Shape is like this. So here I just got H3. Before I said H12, so the difference is just the question of what happened to this one. So let me try to remember what the deal is with that. So the statement is that, the number of scalars that you get, you really get the whole cohomology. So you don't just get H12, you get H12 plus this other one. But the way that they enter into the interactions and the way that they enter into the supersymmetry structure, what I'm saying is that at the level of just counting the massless particles, what I said here is correct. But there's a little bit of finer structure that the particles have, such as how they interact and how they transform under the supersymmetry, which kind of breaks them up, which distinguishes this one from these ones. And then these are just the complex conjugates. So last time when I was talking about mirror symmetry, I was interested a little bit in this finer structure, and so I mentioned the H12 separately.